Namaste. So we resume this evening in chapter 22, Rebirth in Other Worlds in the Life Divine. We interrupted Sri Aurobindo's argument of the common view of what compels the soul's birth into the world and its passage. Metaphysically compelled to birth because it makes an error of ignorance and from the compulsion of desire. And it is compelled by karma from birth to birth, working out the energy of an ethical justice system which seems to base universal law. Sri Aurobindo has made great fun of this argument to this point, and we continue now. These are very summary popular notions and offer no foothold to the philosophic reason and no answer to a search for the true significance of life. A vast world system, which exists only as a convenience for turning endlessly on a wheel of ignorance, with no issue except a final chance of stepping out of it, is not a world with any real reason for existence. A world which serves only as a school of sin and virtue, and consists of a system of rewards and whippings, does not make any better appeal to our intelligence. The soul or spirit within us, if it is divine, immortal or celestial, cannot be sent here solely to be put to school for this kind of crude and primitive moral education. If it enters into the ignorance, it must be because there is some larger principle or possibility of its being that has to be worked out through the ignorance. If, on the other hand, it is a being from the infinite, plunged for some cosmic purpose into the obscurity of matter and growing to self-knowledge within it, its life here and the significance of that life must be something more than that of an infant coddled and whipped into virtuous ways. It must be a growth out of an assumed ignorance towards its own full spiritual stature, with a final passage into an immortal consciousness, knowledge, strength, beauty, divine purity and power. And for such a spiritual growth, this law of karma is all too puerile. Puerile means childish. Even if the soul is something created, an infant being that has to learn from nature and grow into immortality, it must be by a larger law of growth and not by some divine code of primitive and barbaric justice. This idea of karma is a construction of the smaller part of the human vital mind, concerned with its petty rules of life and its desires and joys and sorrows, and directing their puny standards into the law and aim of the cosmos. These notions cannot be acceptable to the thinking mind. They have too evidently the stamp of a construction fashioned by our human ignorance. I think we can applaud the mastery of language there. So on the way, he has scotched not simply the typical views of what we would call ordinary Hinduistic thought, but also challenged, at its very principle, the Buddhistic view of nature, and given to the soul a much more noble enterprise. Let's continue. But the same solution can be elevated to a higher level of reason and given a greater plausibility and the color of a cosmic principle. The solution he's talking about here is karmic compulsion. What is it that's behind that? For first, it may be based on the unassailable ground that all energies in nature must have their natural consequence. If any are without visible result in the present life, it may well be that the outcome is only delayed, not withheld forever. Each being reaps the harvest of his works and deeds, the returns of the action put forth by the energies of his nature, and those which are not apparent in his present birth must be held over for a subsequent existence. It is true that the result of the energies and actions of the individual may accrue not to himself but to others when he is gone. For that we see constantly happening. It happens, indeed, even during a man's lifetime, that the fruits of his energies are reaped by others. But this is because there is a solidarity and a continuity of life in nature, and the individual cannot altogether, even if he so wills, live for himself alone. But if there is a continuity of his own life by rebirth for the individual, and not only a continuity of the mass life and the cosmic life, if he has an ever-developing self, nature, and experience, then it is inevitable that for him too, the working of his energies should not be cut off abruptly, but must bear their consequence at some time in his continuous and developing existence. The idea then that if we put energy into an action, should there not be a return, a recoil, a response from nature about the meaning of that action? What should be delivered back to us? If it isn't delivered in this moment, in this life, then it must be postponed for the later, for another inning, in a different life, or our energies often are shared collectively. Man's being, nature, circumstances of life, are the result of his own inner and outer activities, not something fortuitous and inexplicable. He is what he has made himself. The past man was the father of the man that now is. The present man is the father of the man that will be. Each being reaps what he sows. From what he does, he profits. For what he does, he suffers. This is the law and chain of karma, of action, of the work of nature energy, and it gives a meaning to the total course of our existence, nature, character, action, which is absent from other theories of life. It is evident on this principle that a man's past and present karma must determine his future birth and its happenings and circumstances, for these two must be the fruit of his energies. All that he was and did in the past must be the creator of all that he now is and experiences in his present. And all that he is and is doing in the present must be the creator of what he will be and experience in the future. Man is the creator of himself. He is the creator also of his fate. All this is perfectly rational and unexceptionable so far as it goes. And the law of karma may be accepted as a fact, as part of the cosmic machinery. For it is so evident, rebirth once admitted, as to be practically indisputable. And he has, just to touch upon it again, arrived at a position that the innate soul stuff within us is cognate with the supreme existence, consciousness in bliss, which has multiplied its oneness, and each aspect of multiplicity coming out of that oneness exists eternally and can, if it so wishes, plunge itself into the depths of the cosmic machinery to have a go at experience in nature. Nothing compels us to be here except this vast communion that we have with the Supreme Divine. That is why we came, that is why we continue. It is by our acceptance of the nature of the game that we are here. Well, I depart from his argument. I apologize. Let's get back to what Sri Aurobindo writes here. There are, however, two riders to this first proposition which are less general and authentic and bring in a doubtful note. For though they may be true in part, they are overstated and create a wrong perspective because they are put forward as the whole sense of karma. The first is that, as is the nature of the energies, so must be the nature of the results. The good must bring good results. The evil must bring evil results. The second is that the master word of karma is justice, and therefore good deeds must bear the fruit of happiness and good fortune, and evil deeds must bear the fruit of sorrow, misery, and ill fortune. Since there must be a cosmic justice which is looking on and in controlling in some way the immediate and visible operations of nature and life, but is not apparent to us in the facts of life as seen by us, it must be present and evident in the totality of our unseen dealings. It must be the subtle and hardly visible, but strong and firm secret thread that holds together the otherwise incoherent details of her dealings with her creatures. If it be asked why actions alone, good or bad deeds alone, should have a result, it might be conceded that good or evil thoughts, feelings, actions have all their corresponding results. But since action is the greater part of life, and the test and formulated power of a man's values of being, since also he is not always responsible for his thoughts and feelings, as they are often involuntary, but is or must be held responsible for what he does, as that is subject to his choice, it is mainly his actions that construct his fate. They are the chief or the most forceful determinants of his being and his future. This is the whole law of karma. And there's a great deal we could say about that and how the Buddha interpreted karma in a slightly different sense, giving greater weight to the intent, the psychological intent behind an action, not so much the action done involuntarily or without direction or without volition. But let's continue with Sri Aurobindo's argument. We can have a separate class on the Buddhistic idea of karma. But we have first to observe that a law or chain of karma is only an outward machinery and cannot be elevated to a greater position as the sole and absolute determinant of the life workings of the cosmos, unless the cosmos is itself entirely mechanical in its character. It is indeed held by many that all is law and process, and there is no conscious being or will in or behind the cosmos. If so, here is a law and process that satisfies our human reason and our mental standards of right and justice, and it has the beauty and truth of a perfect symmetry and a mathematical accuracy of working. But all is not law and process. There is also being and consciousness. There is not only a machinery, but a spirit in things. Not only nature and law of cosmos, but a cosmic spirit. Not only a process of mind and life and body, but a soul in the natural creature. If it were not so, there could be no rebirth of a soul and no field for a law of karma. But if the fundamental truth of our being is spiritual and not mechanical, it must be ourself, our soul, that fundamentally determines its own evolution, and the law of karma can only be one of the processes it uses for that purpose. Our spirit, our self, must be greater than its karma. So this is Sri Aurobindo's thunderous answer to the idea that there can be a rebirth of a non-being, that the soul that doesn't exist should come back for a second inning. Does not make sense to Sri Aurobindo. The soul, like Sat, exists. It is an aspect of Sat. It cannot be abolished or exterminated by death, and it comes back again and again to birth for its particular purposes. As he says, it determines its own evolution, and karma is the engine by which it exacts from nature what it demands. There is a deep conspire to breathe together among the supreme above, its will being worked out here in the cosmic machinery, and the soul which enters in and works forwards through the cosmos to reveal some secret to itself, of itself, and of the world about. So Sri Aurobindo says then, there is law, but there is also spiritual freedom. In other words, we are not owned by the machinery of karma. We are not really captives of it. Law and process, he says, are one side of our existence, and their reign is over our outer mind, life, and body, for these are mostly subject to the mechanism of nature. But even here, their mechanical power is absolute only over body and matter, for law becomes more complex and less rigid, process more plastic and less mechanical, when there comes in the phenomenon of life. And yet more is this so when mind intervenes with its subtlety. An inner freedom already begins to intervene, and the more we go within, the soul's power of choice is increasingly felt. For Prakriti is the field of law and process, but the soul, the Purusha, is the giver of the sanction, Anumanta. And even if ordinarily it chooses to remain a witness and concede an automatic sanction, it can be, if it wills, the master of its nature, Ishvara. So this, of course, is a reference back to the Sankhya philosophy, an extension of the germinal insights of the great sage Kapila, and insisting that subtler and subtler powers of the being, reaching back towards the nature of the soul, are freer and freer from the processes and the claims of material nature. Those laws are operative in the physical dimension and have rightful supremacy there. But as life asserts itself, as mind asserts itself through life upon matter, we move towards a real freedom. We don't get it all at once. We don't get it simply from manifesting mind. We must find soul within and proceed to a consciousness beyond mind to have perfect freedom of spirit in nature, in matter. He continues, it is not conceivable that the spirit within is an automaton in the hands of karma, a slave in this life of its past actions. The truth must be less rigid and more plastic. If a certain amount of results of past karma is formulated in the present life, it must be with the consent of the psychic being which presides over the new formation of its earth experience and assents not merely to an outward compulsory process, but to a secret will and guidance. That secret will is not mechanical, but spiritual. The guidance comes from an intelligence which may use mechanical processes, but is not their subject. Self-expression and experience are what the soul seeks by its birth into the body. Whatever is necessary for the self-expression and experience of this life, whether it intervenes as an automatic outcome of past lives, or as a free selection of results and a continuity, or as a new development, whatever is a means of creation of the future, that will be formulated. For the principle is not the working out of a mechanism of law, but the development of the nature through cosmic experience, so that eventually it may grow out of the ignorance. Self-expression and experience are what the soul seeks by its birth. So experience draws us into the universe. We are looking to experience what is here, what is hidden in this apparent darkness. Experience, if you remember, is what delivers its secrets as knowledge and mastery. We come to be sovereign in the cosmos through our experience, which delivers a greater knowledge than mind can assess. Experience calls us here. Experience finds our key to complete the formula. Part of the formula is discovery of mind, life, and body in an integrated whole. The rest of the formula is an evolution into a new consciousness. There must, therefore, be two elements: karma as an instrument, but also the secret consciousness and will within working through the mind, life, and body as the user. Fate, whether purely mechanical or created by ourselves, a chain of our own manufacture, is only one factor of existence. Being and its consciousness and its will are a still more important factor. And of course, as they manifest here, this is the nature of Sat. Through its conscious force, its chit shakti, will is an expression of its conscious power, of being. Satchit Ananda, while it is supernally above, is here intimate to us, insisting that all of its secrets work out. Its will, invisibly applied, is everywhere at work. In Indian astrology, which considers all life circumstances to be karma, mostly predetermined or indicated in the graph of the stars, there is still provision made for the energy and force of the being, which can change or cancel part or much of what is so written, and even all but the most imperative and powerful bindings of karma. So this system of science in India, Indian astrology, still concedes that the soul has the power to cancel its karma, at least in part. This is a reasonable account of the balance, but there is also to be added to the computation the fact that destiny is not simple but complex. The destiny which binds our physical being binds it so long or in so far as a greater law does not intervene. action belongs to the physical part of us. It is the physical outcome of our being. But behind our surface is a freer life power, a freer mind power, which has another energy and can create another destiny and bring it in to modify the primary plan. And when the soul and self emerges, when we become consciously spiritual beings, that change can cancel or wholly remodel the graph of our physical fate. Karma, then, or at least any mechanical law of karma, cannot be accepted as the sole determinant of circumstances and the whole machinery of rebirth and of our future evolution. Soul power, then, cancels the need for this kind of karmic guidance. We need karma to guide us in the early innings, to direct us down a particular path. But when we grow fully up and become the great souls that we in truth are, then we can set aside these childish things and live more freely in the spirit and its power. So karma cannot absolutely determine us. In other words, this is Sri Aurobindo's answer to the law of determinism. No, we are subject to the law of determinism only so far as we live as physical beings. The more we call in the higher powers of a secret nature, powers of life, powers of mind, powers of soul, reach upwards towards the supramental, then we have no need for the yoking to nature that karma offers, because we can grow without it. We can find and forge a path forward without karma. But this is not all. For the statement of the law errs by an oversimplification and the arbitrary selection of a limited principle. Action is a resultant of the energy of the being, but this energy is not of one soul kind. The consciousness force of the spirit manifests itself in many kinds of energies. There are inner activities of mind, activities of life, of desire, passion, impulse, character, activities of the senses and the body, a pursuit of truth and knowledge, a pursuit of beauty, a pursuit of ethical good or evil, a pursuit of power, love, joy, happiness, fortune, success, pleasure, life satisfactions of all kinds, life enlargement, a pursuit of individual or collective objects, a pursuit of the health, strength, capacity, satisfaction of the body. All this makes an exceedingly complex sum of the manifold experience and many-sided action of the spirit and life, and its variety cannot be set aside in favor of a single principle. Neither can it be hammered into so many sections of the single duality of ethical good and evil. Ethics, the maintenance of human standards of morality, cannot, therefore, be the sole preoccupation of the cosmic law or the sole principle of determination of the working of karma. Ah, glad to be free of that stern jester, sir. If it is true that the nature of the energy put forth must determine the nature of the result or outcome, all these differences in the nature of the energy have to be taken into account, and each must have its appropriate consequence. An energy of seeking for truth and knowledge must have as its natural outcome, its reward or recompense, if you will, a growth into truth, an increase in knowledge. An energy used for falsehood should result in an increase of falsehood in the nature and a deeper immersion in the ignorance. An energy of pursuit of beauty should have as its outcome an increase in the sense of beauty, the enjoyment of beauty, or if so directed, in the beauty and harmony of the life and the nature. A pursuit of physical health, strength, and capacity should create the strong man or the successful athlete. An energy put out in the pursuit of ethical good must have as its outcome or reward or recompense an increase in virtue, the happiness of ethical growth, or the sunny felicity and poise and purity of a simple and natural goodness. While the punishment of opposite energies would be a deeper plunge into evil, a greater disharmony and perversion of the nature, and in case of excess, a great spiritual perdition, Mahati Vinashti. An energy put forward for power or other vital ends must lead to an increase of the capacity for commanding these results or to the development of a vital strength and plenitude. This is the ordinary disposition of things in nature. And if justice be demanded of her, this surely is justice, that the energy and capacity put forward should have in its own kind its fitting response from her. The prize of the race is assigned by her to the swift, the victory in battle to the brave and strong and skillful, the rewards of knowledge to the capable intellect and the earnest seeker. These things she will not give to the good man who is sluggish or weak or skillless or stupid merely because he is righteous or respectable. If he covets these other powers of life, he must qualify for them and put forward the right kind of energy. If nature did otherwise, she could well be accused of injustice. There is no reason to accuse her of injustice for this perfectly right and normal arrangement, or to demand from her a rectification of the balance in a future life, so that the good man may be given as a natural reward for his virtue a high post or a large bank balance or a happy, easy, and well-appointed life. That cannot be the significance of rebirth or a sufficient basis for a cosmic law of karma. So, we began with Sri Aurobindo's dry humor. I think we shall end with his dry humor as well. That's a good place to put a bookmark, I think. Wonderful. This is a selection from Savitri tonight, which is in Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Inner Life, in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. Certainly some of it is relevant to our reading. In the enormous labor of the void, perturbing with her dreams the vast routine and dead roll of a slumbering universe, the mighty prisoner struggled for release. Alive with her yearning, woke the inert cell. In the heart, she kindled a fire of passion and need. Amid the deep calm of inanimate things arose her great voice of toil and prayer and strife. A groping consciousness in a voiceless world, a guideless sense was given her for her road. Thought was withheld, and nothing now she knew, but all the unknown was hers to feel and clasp. Obeying the push of unborn things towards birth, out of her seal of insentient life she broke. In her substance of unthinking, mute soul strength, that cannot utter what its depth divine, awoke a blind necessity to know. The chain that bound her, she made her instrument. Instinct was hers, the chrysalis of truth, and effort and growth and striving nescience. Inflicting on the body desire and hope, imposing on inconscience consciousness, she brought into matter's dull tenacity her anguished claim to her lost sovereign right, her tireless search, her vexed uneasy heart, her wandering unsure steps, her cry for change. Adorer of a joy without a name, in her obscure cathedral of delight, to dim dwarf gods she offers secret rites. But vain, unending is the sacrifice. The priest, an ignorant mage who only makes futile mutations in the altar's plan and casts blind hopes into a powerless flame. A burden of transient gains weighs down her steps, and hardly under that load can she advance. But the hours cry to her. She travels on, passing from thought to thought, from want to want. Her greatest progress is a deepened need. Matter dissatisfies. She turns to mind. She conquers earth, her field, then claims the heavens. Insensible, breaking the work she has done, the stumbling ages over her labor pass. But still no great transforming light came down, and no revealing rapture touched her fall. Only a glimmer sometimes splits mind's sky, justifying the ambiguous providence that makes of night a path to unknown dawns, or a dark clue to some diviner state. In nescience began her mighty task. In ignorance she pursues the unfinished work, for knowledge gropes, but meets not wisdom's face. Ascending slowly with unconscious steps, a foundling of the gods, she wanders here like a child soul left near the gates of hell, fumbling through fog in search of paradise. So, namaste. Jai Ma. We continue in this chapter next week. And after this chapter, then the last six, which Sri Aurobindo wrote specially for the revised version of the Life Divine. And that is a march to glory.